KZSU Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law, as well as a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. Welcome to the show. Glad you're listening in. Today we're going to be turning back on Hearsay Culture to an area that we've occasionally discussed. That is the world of the commons and even infrastructure a bit with a guest I'm very excited to have on, Professor Brett Frischman, who's an associate professor at Loyola University Chicago School of Law. Brett is a prolific scholar with numerous articles that have been published over the last several years in areas ranging from copyright law to current work in the antitrust environment, quite a bit of work in the world of public infrastructure and infrastructural questions, which is an area of particular interest to me. And in fact, Brett's work actually has influenced my own work. And indeed, the last article that I had published, I cited his work extensively. And today we're going to be discussing in particular the world of cultural environmentalism. Brett had a review of Yochai Benckler's The Wealth of Networks that came out in the University of Chicago Law Review this past summer. And his review we'll really be using as a jumping-off point to discuss the larger issues of what cultural environmentalism is, in the context of The Wealth of Networks, but also more broadly, what that community is about, where we are, what it means, and really we're going to have a fairly wide-ranging discussion about the commons generally. Now, the commons is something that we're going to have to define, but this is a term that is bandied around quite a bit, and oftentimes it's misunderstood. You know, does it mean that everything's free? Does it mean that you can't have property? Does it mean that anyone that wants to make a buck off of what they do can't do it? Who are the beneficiaries of commons, or colloquially what you might call the public domain? All of these kinds of issues, you know, certainly need to be explored. I've tried to explore them here on Hearsay Culture with guests like Larry Lessig, as well as other guests. In fact, coming up in the very near future, John Walensky, a professor at Stanford, who's written the book The Access Principle, making a strong case for all scholarship to be made freely available to the public. And many others who have tried to grapple with this very challenging question of what we do with information in a society, in a culture, in an economy that values people's ability to earn a living off of what they do, and how ultimately, from a very basic standpoint, do we deal with those questions? Now, I focus on intellectual property, as does Brett, but obviously these issues can be contextualized much more broadly. We are going to focus on the commons and an intellectual property quite a bit here, but that's something to keep in mind as well. By way of very brief background before we start the conversation, Professor Frischman, Brett joined the Loyola faculty in 2002. His focus is intellectual property and technology law. Prior to joining the faculty, Brett was a law clerk for the Honorable Fred I. Parker of the United States District Court for the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. He graduated Order of the Coif from Georgetown, and while he was in law school, he was an Olin Research Fellow in Law and Economics, and the Executive Development Editor of the Georgetown International Environmental Law Review. He was an associate at Wilmer Cutler and Pickering upon graduation, where he focused in communications, e-commerce, and intellectual property law. He also held visiting appointments at Fordham University School of Law this past fall, as well as at Syracuse. And he will be visiting with Cornell Law School during the 2008-2009 academic year. So I'm very excited to have Brett on the show, and I want to start the conversation. So if I've done my job properly, on the phone here is Brett. Brett, are you there?
I am here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to talk with you today.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show and taking time out of your schedule to chat with Hearsay Culture listeners. So let's jump right in. And what I think is always useful when I start these conversations is to find out a little bit more. I mean, I've done a brief introduction, but what is your scholarly focus, and how did you get into the issues that that you focus on in your scholarship?
Well, my scholarly focus tends to be pretty wide ranging. And crosses a variety of different areas and even disciplines. So, I mean, I suppose the places that I delve into most are information, intellectual property, and information policy or communications policy as well. But also, I write and think about environmental law and policy, and even write occasionally in international law. So, in terms of the areas that I cover, it's pretty wide ranging. I tend to think in terms of different types of resource systems and think about them in a relatively open manner and from a couple of different disciplines. So in terms of the disciplines, I approach things from a legal perspective, thinking like a law professor. That is where I teach in a law school, but I also think about things from an economics and a political science perspective as well. So the scholarship that I'm doing right now and most heavily focused on is connected with concepts of infrastructure and commons that I think is what we're going to probably spend a bunch of time talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I do tend to sort of range across a bunch of different areas.
Let's jump into infrastructure more generally before we kind of drill down on it a bit. Infrastructure, of course, is an ambiguous term, so I might ask for a general definition of infrastructure, and then specifically, if you can trace it. I'm interested in it as well, and it's a somewhat, it may sound like a fairly esoteric focus. What do you mean by infrastructure, and how did you, or why did you become interested in this particular aspect?
The infrastructure, I mean, we could define infrastructure in a variety of ways, and it's actually perhaps hard to nail it down exactly. So the starting place for thinking about infrastructure is probably sort of foundational resources, resources that are sort of foundational in the sense that they are essential for supporting different resource systems, things that are built on top of the infrastructure. And so the sort of common set of things that come to mind when we think about infrastructure are sort of large-scale physical resources, things like, you know, communications networks and road systems, power grid, things like that. And in my work, I tend to to sort of look for the commonalities across those types of infrastructure, but then look for other foundational resources in other resource areas, in the environmental area, or in the information or intellectual area. What are the foundational resources that support different productive activities or allow users to do different things within the system, within economic or social or political systems? I approach infrastructure relatively broadly. And I think you also asked sort of more generally, sort of how does one who teaches intellectual property and whose focus is in a law school, how do you arrive at, you know, focusing on infrastructure?
It's right.
Esoteric. You tend to think people who deal with infrastructure are either a narrow sub-discipline within economics or maybe in civil engineering.
Right.
But not many law professors really focus on infrastructure as their sort of area of interest. And it's kind of an interesting, I mean, I think there are seeds of, I've been sort of thinking about infrastructure and resource systems since I was a law student and wrote sort of a pair of articles, one on the economics of science and technology policy and another on the privatization of the internet infrastructure. And in the latter article, the obvious infrastructure resource in question was the internet infrastructure itself, the physical and logical infrastructure, the resources that support connectivity across networks. But in the science and technology piece, I was also sort of grappling with notions about infrastructure and thinking about basic research within universities, for example,
mm-hmm.
as the infrastructural resource for which that was sort of supportive of downstream research and innovation. And in moving from the, you know, those two articles were where I was sort of as a student and then my first couple of years out of law school sort of thinking about these sets of issues. And then I started sort of grappling with an idea for looking at across disciplines what are the set of resources that we tend to manage as commons or make openly accessible to those within a community in a couple of different areas. And I started thinking about environmental. So in the environmental area, there's a rich literature about commons and common resources. So I started thinking, well, what are the kinds of resources that we manage as commons in the environmental area?
Mm-hmm.
And then at the same time, can we think about the connections perhaps with the resources that we tend to manage as commons or make openly accessible to the public within the intellectual area? What are the intellectual resources we can think of as that we need to manage as commons? And you referred to the public domain a few minutes ago, and I think that's sort of what we tend to think of and lump a bunch of resources into the concept of a public domain. And then the third area was the Internet. So what are the kinds of resources that we want to manage as a commons in the Internet area? And sort of just struggling, I mean, not struggling, but sort of grappling with, you know, what are the similarities and differences across these three different areas, these three important resource systems, what is that subset of things that we want to manage as a commons where it might make sense to manage them as a commons?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what I eventually, after a couple of years of reading plenty of literature in economics and political science and a variety of disciplines in each of those different areas focused on the foundational resources in each of those areas, I started to kind of narrow myself down to thinking about, well, there's these common notions of infrastructure, common notions of foundational resources that are necessary for lots of other things to happen,
mm-hmm.
for the system to sort of seem to be vibrant and functioning. And so some examples are, you know, in the environmental area, I thought about, you know, things like ecosystems and the atmosphere and lakes. We regulate access to those things, but we at the same time, generally speaking, the population has common or open access to those resources for a wide variety of different activities that they engage in.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of, you know, moved similarly into the information area and thought about ideas and other things that we tend to make publicly accessible or openly accessible. And, you know, similarly in the Internet context. Let me see if you have questions.
Your explanation, I think, is important because this is such an ill-defined term, and it's indeed a term that's quite difficult to define anyway. I know for me, when I think about why I've written in public infrastructure from the broadest standpoint, I view it as kind of put another way, I see infrastructural issues as a prerequisite to being able to develop a system of information sharing that can lead us to the kinds of benefits that we want or we hope to have from people getting full access to knowledge and information. But without that core infrastructure in place that embodies those kinds of values, it's, you feel like the, proverbial Sisyphus. And so that's where, that's my ultimate motivation. But of course, that is the broad stroke glorious idea, getting down to brass tacks and defining these terms is a very different challenge. And it's one where I think it's the definition of infrastructure, and I think you'll agree, is still being written. Which leads me kind of to another background point, you know, before we get into more details. But, you know, I used the phrase cultural environmentalism, and perhaps you could define that phrase for us and what that means in the context of infrastructure and what we've been discussing.
Sure. The, I mean, cultural environmentalism is largely, well, we can think of it in three ways, I suppose. It might be understood as a metaphor, b, a movement, c, an analytical framework, or d, all of these things, right? And we could kind of, and I think that d makes sense. I mean, I think d, it's all of those things, and the question is, you know, so in terms of saying what it is and working through how it might be useful, it depends on what we're talking about. I mean, as a metaphor, it's a metaphor that evokes reference to you know, more traditional environmentalism dealing with natural resources or our natural environment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's meant to suggest, I think, that you know, it's there's something about the natural environment as opposed to the cultural environment that we want to pay attention to, right? And this is sort of this the idea of cultural environmentalism originates, as I sort of explained in the review I wrote of Yochai Benkler's book, with Jamie Boyle's work, and initially his book, and then a couple of then a couple of articles that came afterwards, where he suggests that we can think about the enclosure movement that's taking place, what he calls called the second enclosure movement, sort of in intellectual or cultural space, as really being sort of the second enclosure movement, and we can think about it as being comparable to the first enclosure movement with the physical landscape.
Before Brad, let me jump in, because I think the enclosure movement is one that perhaps requires an explanation for those not as well versed.
Oh, okay, yeah, right. So by the enclosure movement, the idea is what Boyle and others who talk about the enclosure movement are focusing on is the movement to, or the, you know, you can think of it as a movement that's political or a movement that is social, but a movement to enclose or increasingly privatize through private property rights, or propertize a set of resources. And so the first enclosure movement was the privatization and propertization of the landscape. Right, so the resources we're thinking about physical land. The second enclosure movement that Boyle describes quite well concerns the privatization and propertization of culture, of intellectual resources, through the expansion of intellectual property rights, for example. And so there's been plenty of scholars who have documented and discussed and criticized the expansion of copyright. I'm sure you've talked about in past shows, you know, with the Eldred decision, for example, sort of expanding the duration of copyright, but also in terms of the scope of copyright, the kinds of subject matter of copyright, the types of things that are copyrightable. All of those things are sort of arguably part of an enclosure movement, the movement to enclose intellectual resources or expression.
And by enclosure, we mean literally the ability to control its use. Am I right in saying that?
The control of use. use of
whatever the resources is,
privatized or privatized.
Right. And is that, I guess, to contextualize this, is that the core concern for those who look at the enclosure movement and raise alarms?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think there's a lot of what's really difficult in this area is that there's a bunch of layered concerns. I mean, I think on one hand there is the concern with just delegation to private property owners the ability to control how certain resources are used.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Of course, that in part what intellectual property is designed to do. It's designed to delegate to a copyright owner the ability to control certain sets of uses of the expression that's copyrighted, subject to copyright. But, you know, there's certain uses that remain available to consumers or users, or at least we might think they remain available. And there are certain things that, like ideas, the ideas that are expressed. The expression may be copyrightable, but the ideas are not. And so the use of the underlying idea remains something that copyright law has resisted enclosure pressures, for example. I mean, there's no enclosure there. So one layer of concern is with, you know, who gets to control certain aspects or certain ranges of, you know, certain types of uses of expression and ideas and, you know, different aspects of our culture. I think another layer of a concern, it's sort of a little bit more abstract, is with the very notion of enclosure, is with the notion mm-hmm. of privatization and propertization, of commodifying things, about relying on markets and private actors to set the course of cultural progress,
mm-hmm.
and sort of what kinds of culture we consume and we participate in. I think it's a more subtle and abstract notion because it's not necessarily explicit. When we talk about expanding copyright,
mm-hmm.
So in the discussion about, say, Eldred or about some other shift in copyright law, the focus may be on, well, this is increasingly, you know, restricting public access to the underlying expression, right? We have to wait that much longer to get access, and that's that first aspect of enclosure, that first aspect or that first concern we have, which is who gets to control the expression and our access and use of the expression.
Mm-hmm.
But the more subtle point about, I think, the subtle, more subtle point about the direction that our culture is going and the type of culture that we support and the increased reliance on markets and private actors motivated by profit within a market system sort of direct our path, you know, choose the path we proceed along in terms of culture is a hidden, I mean, it's not a hidden concern, but it's a concern that's, I think, there and that is often motivating, so, you know, the critiques of the enclosure movement.
Mm-hmm.
I shouldn't say, I mean, I don't want to go too far with this, because I think that markets do a pretty decent job of allocating resources to a variety of different, to the production of a variety of different things that we want, including many cultural goods. And copyright enables markets and is intended to enable various markets to function effectively. And that's a good thing. The question, as always, at least in copyright policy, is about how far the law goes and how far, how we establish the balance between markets and say, commons or other modes of cultural production.
And that, you know, that leads us back to the cultural environmentalism issue, because, you know, environmentalism itself, at least until recently, it may be changing, but certainly a lot of people, I think, have a visceral reaction to environmentalism and what that means, and whether it suggests some kind of radical view of the earth and of people's role on it. Now, I think the, and I don't want to discuss the environmental movement in particular, but I think that there may be more general recognition that perhaps we should all be concerned about the state of our environment. But when we analogize to environmentalism, what is the analogy that, as you mentioned, that, you know, J.B. Boyle in his Shame and Software and Spleen's book and several other authors since then, scholars have attempted to derive? What is the analogy to the environmental movement that the cultural environmentalism, quote unquote, movement is attempting to derive?
Well, I think, I think the analogy is the common element or the common term is environment, right? And the difference is cultural versus, say, natural. When we talk about the environment or just plain old environmentalism, we don't really modify it with the natural environmental, that natural environment, but that's kind of what we're referring to. The common term environment is I think meant to evoke the idea of sort of a system of resources that are interdependent in some sense that sort of define or constitute or the context within which we live, our surroundings, our setting. We inherit it, we live within it, we use it, we interact with it, we change it, and we modify it, and we pass it on to future generations. And the idea is that, you know, that the notion of an environment seems natural. I mean, we can talk about the natural environment. It seems to make, you know, we can easily understand what that means, and we can understand that there are a variety, and, you know, this is sort of this maybe becomes a more complex point than we want to get into, but there's a variety of reasons why we have, we take for granted the physical environment within which we live. Mm-hmm. We fail to appreciate how certain activities that we engage in affect the environment, both in terms of, you know, in terms of long-term costs that affect us, long-term costs that affect others, and that, you know, there's a whole set of problems we can identify and concerns we can identify with respect to the natural environment. And I think the metaphor, the analogy is helpful on one hand in sort of just in evoking the notion that, well, the same can be said with respect to our cultural, you know, the set of resources that are cultural in nature that aren't necessarily seen by us and felt by us physically,
mm-hmm.
But nonetheless are functionally related in the same way, in a similar way, and at the same time constitute or comprise our context or our surroundings or the setting that we live within and interact with and pass on to future generations in the same sense. And that, you know, there are a set of concerns raised in the natural environmental context that also arise in the cultural environmental context. We think about our cultural environment. And so I've written a little bit about sort of the notion that we've got sort of many different overlapping environments that sort of constitute the world we live in. Some of them are natural, but we can think of the natural environment as being one type, but there are sort of socially constructed environments as well. And, you know, the cultural environment can be thought of in that way. The metaphor also extends, I think, into the second point about there being a movement, and this is in part, I think, what Boyle was attempting to accomplish, and I think was pretty successful in accomplishing, which was the idea that, you know, by labeling the natural environment the environment, I mean, there really isn't, it's very hard to say what the environment is when talking in the natural world context, right? There are a variety of different ecosystems, different resources that relate to each other in very complex ways. But one advantage of labeling it the environment is that you can grab up a whole set of issues, aggregate them together, focus your attention on those issues, and motivate different constituencies from a political standpoint to get to become active, to seek to you know, get behind regulation. And, you know, the environmental movement was very successful. It was also coupled, I mean, besides the fact that there was a movement, it was also coupled with scientific advances, increased understanding of the consequences of human action on the natural environment. But, you know, you couple a bunch of those things together, and sort of Boyle says, look, that was successful in the environmental area in terms of developing a movement for giving rise to change and regulation in the environment, in the emergence of a pretty robust set of environmental laws, Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, etc. You know, and he was basically saying we need something similar with respect to the cultural environment, right? Same set of problems, same set of interests. We care about the cultural environment much like we care about the natural environment because it sets the context and conditions within which we live. It's similarly subject to a variety of risks and, you know, problems. Markets fail to protect both our natural environment and our cultural environment for a variety of reasons, and so we ought to aggregate different concerns together by attaching sort of a label, a cultural environment label, as a sort of way to bring together different constituencies so that they can talk to each other, begin to understand the shared problems that they face in their disparate areas, and motivate political action that might lead to change.
And that's where I think we'll take a quick break here, because I think after the break we can bring this into you know, a brief discussion of Benkler's work in this area. You're listening to Hearsay Culture on KZSU FM Stanford. Dave Levine in discussion with Professor Brett Frischman of Loyola University, Chicago. As everyone listening to the show by now should know, anyone that's heard the show before, KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station located at Stanford University that requires, indeed it survives, on donations from listeners in order to maintain its diverse programming. And for those of you listening by podcast, be aware of the fact that the show, in fact, originates on KZSU as a radio show, and in fact, it is through KZSU that Hearsay Culture continues its existence. So I ask for money not for me, but for KZSU. If you're interested in making a donation to KZSU, you can email KZSU's underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to KZSU's webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I do hope you keep listening to KZSU and to Hearsay Culture, and that you continue to enjoy KZSU's diverse programming. Let's return to the conversation with Professor Brett Frischman. And Brett, before that very short break, I had mentioned going into Benkler's work. Now, I'll say up front, you are not Yochai Benkler, for those that are just tuning in now, and I'm not asking you to represent Professor Benkler, but perhaps you could, of course, I ask this question knowing that Professor Benkler's work is quite far-ranging and quite dense and has a variety of contributions to this area. So I'm going to ask a question, which is, I think, probably somewhat silly, but if one were to attempt to crystallize what Professor Benkler is attempted to do and did do with respect to the wealth of networks, what is the contribution that you see in his book to this larger discussion of cultural environmentalism in the commons?
Well, that's the subject of the book review. So it's the book review I wrote and published in the University of Chicago Law Review was one of those book reviews that sort of goes beyond just reviewing what he said and sort of suggests, attempts to suggest how his work might fit in with this concept or be understood through the lens of cultural environmentalism. I think that, I guess terms of trying to crystallize or nail down what his contribution is, I agree with you. It's tricky because I think he accomplishes a whole lot. I mean,
right.
A very far-ranging book that makes a number of contributions that even in the book review I sort of suggest, I mean, I can only tackle a few of them. But I think that I thought by framing the review in terms of culture and environmentalism, I could sort of shed light on two things that he does that I think are quite interesting. I mean, his basic thesis, if I can be so bold to say what I think his basic thesis is that the wealth of networks is the potential for widespread participation in the making, sharing, and experiencing of our information environment or our cultural environment. So I think the idea is that the networked economy, the networked information environment, as he calls it, you know, the combination of the internet or a heavily networked society with communications capabilities as well as the computer capabilities, the digitization of all kinds of different content, but that this networked economy or this networked information environment unlocks our potential as human beings, the human potential to do a whole lot. It enables us to participate in a variety of different activities, making, sharing, experiencing of culture in a way that just hasn't been seen before. And he claims that this change, this potential for participation, is actually being realized to some extent, and that change is in fact underway. And you know, one significant contribution of his book, at least viewed in the light of the culture of environmentalism, I think, is that he offers a very rich, descriptive account of the various technologies involved in the networked information environment, as well as the economics of those technologies and our participation. And he does that through an interesting set of examples. And you know, the examples he uses are you know, illustrative, but there's you know, it's probably only the tip of the iceberg in terms of the variety of different activities that are occurring online that support his descriptive thesis. And I say that that's a contribution to cultural environmentalism because mm-hmm. I think what was missing prior to this, I mean, it's not missing altogether, but if cultural environmentalism is to be taken seriously as more than just sort of a metaphor to sort of organize our thoughts and perhaps more than just a movement to sort of group together people who care about, you know, who want to act politically or get involved in debates, but actually as an analytical framework for scholars or for people who you sort of organize our thinking about things, we need to understand exactly what the cultural environment is, how mm-hmm. it works. Much like the environmental science that you see in the natural environment has progressed significantly over the last 50 years and enabled us to better understand the natural environment so that we can better regulate our own behavior and our own relationships with the environment. And we're still, you know, in need of much more learning, obviously, and that's a sort of an ongoing dynamic kind of process. The same is true in the cultural environment. If it's going to be meaningful to evoke cultural environmentalism, we want to understand what exactly that means. That means understanding all of the systems of cultural production and different types of culture and different cultures themselves and how they relate to each other and how we relate to them. We need, you know, there are cultural studies, there are people who do study this, but we need a lot more, and we also need to integrate what we do know about how cultural production, our relationship with culture, how it works into the debates that we're having in intellectual property and communications and some of these other areas. And I think Benkler makes a tremendous contribution, still only, you know, a few steps in the direction of better, you know, of a full descriptive account. I mean, it's well short of a full descriptive account. But it gives us at least, you know, a level of detail in terms of understanding the relationship between these participatory technologies, the technologies that enable us to participate, as well as the behaviors of those users who are engaged in peer production and or engaged in the use of these technologies online and producing cultural goods on a massive scale. Now, whether or not those cultural goods are, high worth, high quality, I mean, those are questions that he addresses and there's debates about. But I think even putting aside whether or not the outputs or the kind of cultural goods that we get through, people participating in blogs or people who are contributing to Wikipedia or people who are participating on Slashdot, all of these are examples he talks about in his book. I think the quality may increase over time. It, in some cases, is very good already.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not they compete with commercial versions is sort of beside the point. I think what he does that's quite a contribution is to begin to explain and describe how we can understand what the cultural environment consists of, at least in this internet online network space.
And I think the internet aspect,
a lot more could be done along those lines. We need a better understanding of what people are doing when they create,
mm-hmm.
what people are doing when they share their creations and when they produce things jointly and in groups and in a variety of different settings that largely go understudied, at least by those of us in the legal academia who are talking about these issues. But I think that's one aspect of his contribution. I should throw out the second, which is sort of the normative side. So on the descriptive side, I think he does a whole lot to support his argument that this kind of change is taking place or is at least starting to take place. And by the change, I mean increased participation by a wider variety of people in the making, sharing, experiencing of culture. The normative claim that he makes, which I also think he makes some decent headway, and it's relevant to the cultural environmentalism project, I think, is that this kind of change ought to be allowed, if not encouraged. I actually think I should go further. He not only argues that it ought to be allowed, but that it should be encouraged. That he appeals to a variety of liberal political theories, and I think he could also make a very strong argument from other communitarian perspective or some other political approaches would also support the argument. That's something that someone might take on as a project. But he offers a very rich normative account or a rich normative argument supporting the idea that not only is this happening, but it's something that is generally a positive development from a societal perspective. We would like to see increased participation in cultural production along a variety of different dimensions. And I think what he does along this line that's kind of helpful for the broader project is he starts to identify different normative values that are supported by this kind of participation.
It leads me to the question. We have about 10 minutes left, and as I listen to the discussion and hear your explanation, and I'm reminded to some degree of work that I did several years ago for a group called Concord Coalition, which is still very active, that focuses in areas involving deficit reduction, federal deficit reduction, and budget issues. And I'm not going to ask you about federal budget issues. We're not going to go that far afield. So don't get too nervous. But the analogy that I'm thinking of is when I would go to groups of individuals and try to explain to them why they should care about the deficit. This was in the mid-90s. There might be a little more knowledge now, but a lot of it boiled down to trying to explain why people who are not focusing on federal budget issues or not actually seeking to get grants from the federal government, but who just live in the United States should care about the government running, debt. And it becomes very esoteric and very difficult, unless you're an economist, to try to understand why this is important and how it trickles down. And I think that, you know, one of the things you're saying clearly is that Benkler's work and others are all attempting to get us to some kind of practical understanding of what the cultural environmental movement means. So I guess I'll ask you this question, and, you know, again, you know, we have a little bit less than 10 minutes left. What if, you know, the listener who is not immersed in cultural environmentalism, who, you know, is a casual user of technology in the sense that, you know, they go on Google and they do searches, but they're not spending significant amounts of time thinking about these issues. Why should they be concerned about the existence of the cultural and environmental movement? And perhaps, and I know that this is an area that still needs to be developed, but for, do you have any ideas of what the person not immersed in this area can do to support the cultural environmentalism movement, if I can call it that?
Well, I mean, I think the first step to getting involved in anything, any kind of movement, is to educate yourself and understand what the range of issues are and what the stakes are. So I think the first step to anyone who's sort of a casual person who might want to get involved is probably to do a bunch of reading, and probably do a bunch of sort of identifying the range of issues that are close, that are perhaps under the cultural environmentalism umbrella, that might be most relevant to that person. There's a variety of approaches, I suppose, to doing that. I mean, I think that's probably the first step. I think one thing is to, it's sort of a more simple thing, besides sort of saying, like, what steps should you take as an activist or something, or where to look for, supporting organizations. I'm not sure if that's what you're asking.
The broader question of, for someone that isn't writing in this area, we're focusing on it, is there anything that they can do to not only learn, and I certainly agree with that, but also just support the effort, as it were?
One is to support organizations that you find EFF, Electronic Frontier Foundation, for example, or Creative Commons at Stanford, or not at Stanford, but Creative Commons. There are a variety of organizations that I think you could get involved with or find you could support as a means for supporting. But one question I think is sort of implicit in what you're saying is sort of why should they care?
Right.
And I think I was going to tie this when you were talking about your project with debt and why people should care and how hard it was to convince people. It also reminds me, and this is why I write about this stuff extensively, it's the common problem with infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we take so much for granted. So, I mean, one way to think about it is to approaching sort of how can I better understand why this stuff matters is to think about the things that you take for granted, right? What are the things that you just assume are going to be there every day? But if they weren't there every day, it would be hard for things to function certain way.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's one sort of thing. It's common in the infrastructure context. In the cultural environmentalism context, I think at the very beginning of the show I mentioned there being sort of two things that people who think about the enclosure movement might be concerned with. One is the increased delegation to private actors to determine who has access and use over certain cultural goods, certain expression and things like that. And then the second, sort of more subtle, was the idea that the very culture that we inhabit and participate in is shaped increasingly by markets certain types. I shouldn't even say markets, but certain types of markets. That I think is also something for the person who's just perhaps interested but trying to figure out what this is all about. Is to get involved in understanding and trying to figure out what kind of culture that you want,
mm-hmm.
that you want to participate in, becoming more of an active participant in the cultural communities that you may take for granted that you're a part of, whether it's, you know, in academia or, you know, if you're, in, you know, if you're a blog reader, and thinking about participating more actively, and you may become a blog writer, you may become a commentator on blogs, but to sort of think more carefully about the kind of culture that you're participating in. I think just getting a better understanding is helpful.
I think that that's a nice way, actually, to, unfortunately, we're out of time. And this is obviously tip of the iceberg discussion. So, as is often the case, I certainly will invite you back, Brett, sometime in the future to continue the discussion, because I realize we just scratched the surface. Oftentimes I think, well, you know, what are the alternatives? Well, we could have a 3-hour show, but I think a 3-hour discussion might be a little too long, so I certainly invite you back to continue the discussion. Recommend Brett's article, Cultural Environmentalism and the Wealth of Networks, which came out of the University of Chicago, Law Review in the Summer 2007. The citation, for those of you that want to find it, is a 74 University of Chicago Law Review 1083. This gets to my last question for you, Brett. For those that want to learn more about your work in particular, I know you're an active blogger as well. Where can they turn?
Well, I'm a moderately active blogger. My co-bloggers say that I'm the least active on a relatively active blog. But
right.
Yeah, madisonian.net is the blog that I, as a group blog that I participate in. I think most of my articles and writing are available online. Those who are sort of interested in, who are sort of the Google searchers who aren't really involved in this stuff directly, who want sort of an easier, perhaps more accessible entry into some of the work I've done on infrastructure, can check out. There's a First Monday, an essay on First Monday, which is sort of an online peer-edited journal on infrastructure, commons, and economic perspective, from June 2007. And that kind of is a nice, I think, introduction to some of my work on infrastructure. And, you know, and those, of course, who are interested in more, most of the articles are available online, you know, through links on my website or on SS Social Science Research Network. And, of course, I'm in the progress of writing a book.
Right, which I did want to ask you about quickly. What's the focus there?
Well, the focus of the book is on the infrastructure theory and its connection with, you know, commons and managing certain resources in a non-discriminatory way. And then the first part of the book develops a theory of infrastructure that recognizes why the demand side, or why society demands and value, derives value from different types of infrastructural resources. And then the second part of the book will apply that theory to a number of different areas, including, as I sort of mentioned earlier, the environmental information and then internet context. And then the third part will talk about some other issues of application, comparative institutional analysis, and antitrust law, and a variety of other topics, but the different ways in which we actually implement commons through the law is a way to kind of capture, I guess, the latter part.
Well, I won't. I've done this before, but I won't say so. When can we find the book, and when will it come out? I won't put that pressure on you, especially on a radio show. But
I think I've got a manuscript deadline. It's coming out in the Yale University Press.
Uh-huh.
I think that the deadline I've got is a year and a half from now in terms of the manuscript. So I don't think it'll be out for another 2 years or so.
Well, we'll certainly look forward to it, and you know, best of luck meeting those deadlines, Professor Brett Frischman, Loyola University of Chicago School of Law. Thank you so much for joining me today on Hearsay Culture, and for really engaging in what I think is a really fascinating discussion.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. You've been listening to Professor Brett Frischman of the University of Chicago School of Law, and you've been listening to Hearsay Culture on KZSU-FM. We are going to have a pretty active schedule of guests coming up in the following several weeks. Among them will be, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, Professor John Walensky of Stanford University, who's written a very interesting book called The Access Principle, which makes a strong argument for open access to research and scholarship. I'm also looking forward to chatting with Alex Wright, the author of GLUT, a very interesting, insightful book dealing with organization of information, certainly related to the commons issues that we've discussed here. Tim Holbrook, and Bobby Qual, two very well known and very well regarded and highly regarded intellectual property scholars, will also be on the show as well, as well as Jonathan Zittrain, from Harvard, who has a book coming out, focusing in technology law generally. I'm in the process, additionally, of booking other guests who, will be coming up in the next quarter. And this quarter, I believe, ends in about mid-March, so we'll be looking for these guests in April, and I will be posting that schedule, relatively soon on hearsayculture.com, which is the last thing I will say. You can find Hearsay Culture in a number of venues. You can go to hearsayculture.com, where you can find all the shows and schedules. You can also go on iTunes and type Center for Internet and Society, and you will find Stanford Center for Internet and Society's page in the podcast area, and you can find all the shows there, as well as the RSS feed on cyberlaw.stanford.edu. So I want to thank you for listening to Hearsay Culture, and I encourage you to stay tuned to more innovative and exciting programming on KZSU. Thanks, and have a great day.